Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I want you to know that the mothership has landed.
It's DA on CBS Sports Radio.
What's up, my brother? I want permission to come aboard the mothership.
Asking permission to join a sports talk spaceship? Well, we're all a little crazy. The mothership has connected.
The mothership.
Let's go, man.
Man, I'm feeling great.
I'm doing great.
Happy Wednesday to you, boys and girls. One question, how do you feel?
Well, I feel good and I'm doing well.
Hey, that's all that really matters. We come to you live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts studios. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, we'll talk NFL films with producer Shannon Furman, who is producing the All or Nothing series, focusing on the Los Angeles Rams from last year that'll be available on Amazon by the end of the week, in which you can binge watch it if you're a football fan. So we'll do some NFL coming up here behind the scenes. I've talked about this before. NFL films was one of the most important, impressionable things I had in my youth of becoming a sports fan. You know, when I was a young kid, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, my dad used to always watch. He loved the New York Giants from back in the day with the Yankee Stadium, went to games at Yankee Stadium, always used to watch them on Sundays. So when I finally started getting old enough to kind of figure out, okay, this was important for dad, I started watching as well, and watching football on Sundays with him became just a ritual. Like, I wouldn't miss it for the world. But then I also started watching NFL films that happened to play on television. You know, Alcoa's Fantastic Finishes. Oh, I was all in. And when those were on, or Road to the Super Bowl that was on, I used to record that on the VCR and watch it over and over and over again. And then I started asking my dad to buy me the VHS tapes. And so NFL films shaped my entire vision of the NFL as a youth, which is probably why I'm so disappointed with the modern NFL, because I see them going so far away from what had built them up, the magic, the brilliance that had made the league what it was. But I still think NFL Films does absolutely transcendental work. I think their series, Timeline, America's Game, the top 10 series that I'm lucky enough to be a part of, I just think is unbelievably good sports storytelling. And so I'm excited to talk to one of their producers, Shannon Furman, about the All or Nothing series coming up, which debuts on Friday, is released this Friday on Amazon in about 15 minutes from now. The big sports story of the day is Phil Jackson and the New York Knicks parting ways. I mean, if Phil Jackson gets all of his money and did so little to build a winner, that guy has the ultimate heist. That is a jewelry, diamond, Ocean's 11 type heist. That he walked into a situation, made it clearly worse. Before Phil Jackson, Carmelo Anthony and the Knicks actually had a 50-win season, had won a playoff series, had a plus 500 record. After Phil Jackson, they haven't been able to make the playoffs, sub 500 record, and a warring citywide nightmare on a daily basis. Phil could do so little and then leave with all of the money. It's extraordinary that you just basically had a battle between two parties and who was going to get all of their money. Carmelo and his 5-year contract with the Knicks, or Phil and his 5-year contract with the Knicks. And eventually, Phil got the money to not have to work anymore. To put it in perspective, speaking of the history of the game, I think it might be hard to understand unless you were from New York that the affinity the city had for Phil Jackson. Those Knicks teams, which are now 45 years ago, are the last banners that hang in Madison Square Garden. The last championship banners, 1970 and 1973. And all of those Knicks are held up as the icons of teamwork, of basketball IQ, of chemistry, of playing the game in a beautiful way. And New York City gets the nickname the Mecca of basketball for a reason. Basketball means a lot in New York. Means a lot because it's an urban jungle and there's a hoop on every street corner and every park always has somebody shooting hoops in it, and so many great players have been born and raised in New York. And this was the home of the NIT championship for a long time. And this was the home of the Big East tournament. And New York City just has a basketball love affair. Always has, always will. And Phil being part of those teams was respected, admired. You see, here's the thing about those Knicks teams. New Yorkers like to think those Knicks teams were smarter than everybody else. Clyde Frazier, Willis Reed, Dave DeBuscher, Bill Bradley, Phil Jackson, Earl the Pearl Monroe. These are studied, educated, basketball sophisticated guys, savants, that after basketball could go on to government employment, be senators, be CEOs. They were reading novels and books. I mean, even Clyde Frazier became kind of a cartoon, but his linguistics were always remarkable. He always had such an amazing vocabulary. So they are looked at as not only a great team because of teamwork, but also a smarter team. That the way they thought basketball was different. So for Phil now, 45 years later, to be seen as a basketball idiot is astonishing. In just 3 years, here's a guy that is looked at as the conquering hero coming back to New York, can do no wrong. He'll be the guy that fixes it all. He's got 2 rings as a player, 11 rings as a coach. I mean, he was around Michael and Scotty. He was around Kobe and Shaq. This is a guy that could understand how to maneuver and build a team. Guy that reads novels, reads books, and writes poetry, and is in a cabin in Montana, zenning out. I mean, this is a heady guy. And within 3 years, the city looks at him as a complete and utter moron. You know how hard that is? That you could have 45 years of a reputation built up, and then within 3, everybody goes, oh, I guess we were wrong. You know, that's extraordinary. Is his reputation tarnished forever? I don't know. We got short memories. We got short memories, and I think that time heals all wounds really quickly in 2017. And so, hell, I mean, A-Rod is kind of like an embraceable kind of former knucklehead now, but a guy that people like. And there's all types of, I mean, Barry Bonds gets jobs in Major League Baseball. There's all types of former bad guys that people soften on. And I think that'll probably happen with Phil Jackson, that at some point in time in the future, people will not look at him and immediately have their head starting to turn around and vomit pea soup. But for now, from where we sit right now, Phil went from brilliant basketball mind to stupidest basketball mind I've ever seen in just 3 years. In some ways, I got to give you credit, Phil, and you get to walk away with all your money.
You win.
On the topic of monster home runs, this year, talking about steroid era and conquering heroes falling on hard times, Major League Baseball's home run rate is up yet again. And basically every year for the last couple of years, the home run rate continues to increase, even more so than the PED era. This is crazy to think about. But in 1998, when McGuire hits 70 and Sosa hits 66, was it that year? You know, you have all of these steroided, inflated, monster home run hitters. And today, home runs are being hit at a higher rate. We don't have the individual accomplishments, but more players are hitting more home runs today than even in the steroid era. So the New York Post did a breakdown on why. Why is this happening? And they mentioned maybe a more tightly wound baseball. They mentioned that better technology with your bats. Bats are being made better. And that players are physically better nutritionally, stronger. They're looking at exit velocity. They've got more metrics that players are just better. Let's tear apart all of that because that is just ultimate simplicity. The baseball's wound tighter. The bats are made better. The metrics, you know, guys are better at hitting home runs. Here's the reason, is that baseball has now evolved into an all or nothing game. That because there isn't small ball anymore, and because now we have this never-ending parade of power pitchers and relievers, and because the game has valued a guy that throws 100 that can get some guys out versus a guy that throws 89 that can get everybody out, you've got fresher pitchers, more velocity, coming at hitters that are being encouraged, swing for the fences, because I'd rather see a home run or a strikeout then you hit a grounder to first base. And with defensive metrics and defensive shifting, it's harder and harder to put together rallies. More and more teams rely on the home run more than anything to get runs. And balls go out quicker. Forget how they're wound. Forget the bat technology. They're going out quicker when guys throw faster. Faster it comes in, faster it goes out. And this is a problem for baseball because a third of all pitches are never in play. It's either a walk, a strikeout, or a home run. A third of all at-bats, the ball is never in play. And so now it's become kind of a home run derby feel. Look, home runs are still exciting. Gets everybody in the park juiced up. You love seeing the majesty of them. But there's also so little of the old baseball that goes into it. And I think baseball likes it because home runs are souvenirs, home runs are highlights, home runs get people excited. But it really has become, well, if there's not a home run, you're not scoring many runs. Everybody's reliant on that. And so now hitters are using more metrics and they're using all types of angles and try to hit into this angle and this exit velocity with this type of spin and this type of torque. And so they're better scientifically prepared to hit them. But it's weird. Like 15 years ago, hitting a lot of home runs was going to save baseball. Today, hitting a lot of home runs, I don't think it's necessarily great for baseball. When we come back, we'll talk NFL Films with Shannon Furman, producer behind All or Nothing series featuring the Rams' first season in L.A., which debuts this week from Amazon. Next, DA, CBS Sports Radio.
We are the glitch in the simulation.
The DA show is highly intellectual. We're all the way from no IQ to the high IQ. We are cutting edge on this show. Cutting edge.
DA on CBS Sports Radio.
We know where the low IQ comes from.
As a pop culture phenomenon like myself.
Remember, you can always watch the show. The digital broadcast gets better on a daily basis. The digital team here doing a tremendous job upping the ante on a daily basis. So check it out. Go to watchda.com. That's mobile friendly as well. On your laptop or on your mobile device or on your PC, you can watch the show every day, watchda.com. We know NFL Films does epic work. And You think about Hard Knocks last year with the Los Angeles Rams. Well, now an extension, which will debut on Amazon this Friday, Amazon Prime, called All or Nothing, a season with the LA Rams, which is produced by NFL Films. And they follow the Rams throughout the entire 2016 NFL season, their first season in Los Angeles. Joining us from NFL Films is producer Shannon Furman. Shannon, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing very well. Thanks so much for joining us. So when we look at this All or Nothing, talk to us about why this is different, because it's a relatively new project that NFL Films took on, starting kind of last year with the Arizona Cardinals, right?
Yeah, definitely. And this was kind of uncharted territory for us, because we're used to kind of, not that we don't cover every team, but most of the shows we produce are on teams that are winning. You know, with the Cardinals, that was kind of how that started, was Mr. Bidwell thought he had a really good team and asked us to cover the season. And that was how the series was kind of born. So when we were looking for a team for last year, not a lot of teams were familiar with the series yet at the point where you'd be recruiting people. So we had a great relationship with the Rams coming off of Hard Knocks, and we decided to stay. So I left for LA on July 22nd, and I came home on January 4th. I was home maybe 20 days in between there, but it was definitely different for us. So every day as the losing continued, it was just something that we dealt with on a day-by-day basis, and the Rams were great to work with through all of it. They, I think, trusted us because of the relationship we had built. I mean, really since, like, the move was announced. And the editing process was different. So this is all uncharted territory for all of us.
How tense can it be when you are behind the scenes documenting with cameras and microphones losses and tension and a losing season and Jeff Fisher being forced out? How tense and awkward can that be?
It was bad at times. It was something that we weren't used to. I mean, I would say in London, I actually held the cameras out of the post-game locker room in London for safety issues. Like, the guys were just angry, and they had kind of had, like, you know, this long trip and stuff, and, you know, there were things being thrown. People were upset. So I made the choice to kind of just keep the cameras outside of the locker room that night. But, like, honestly, other than that, the team was great. We were in almost every other post-game locker room. We were in when guys got injured. It was really about building a trust, which I think, because I'm the assistant director on Hard Knocks, they kind of knew me coming into it, so it made sense for we used a smaller crew this year than we did as far as directors go on the Cardinals one. But, yeah, I mean, there were tense moments. Things were hard, but they were also very good at, I think you'll see in the series, they had a 24-hour rule. And I was kind of impressed at how they could kind of change their emotions and just start with the next week, like starting on Tuesday. Everybody had kind of moved on, and, like, I never saw them give up. And, you know, there might have been games where you saw them give up at a certain point, but as far as the preparation went on a weekly basis, once Tuesday morning hit, everybody was ready for the next opponent. And every week, even playing the Patriots, they thought they were going to win the game.
Shannon Furman from NFL Films joins us in advance of their new All or Nothing documentary series looking at these Los Angeles Rams in their inaugural season in Los Angeles. So you've got this high-powered equipment worth a lot of money. You've got angry football players in a locker room. Are you worried that they will actually pick up a camera and throw it, or are you worried about something being thrown into the camera?
I was worried about something hitting one of the camera guys, you know, while they're filming, like if a helmet gets tossed or something. I didn't want anyone getting hit in the head with that. I wasn't worried about them picking up us and throwing our equipment around. It was more about just stuff flying around and keeping our guys safe and stuff like that too. But yeah, no, the guys themselves, everybody was great to work with.
You know, when you're going through losing and things aren't great, a lot of guys don't want cameras around to see the pain, to see the angst, to make them look, you know, lesser than or whatever. How hard is that when you're going through a really difficult season like the Rams were, and there's cameras on guys' anguish? Are you seeing guys saying, you know, like, not now, not here, or do they understand that everything has to be filmed?
Yeah, they were, for the most part, they were pretty good about it. There were times where I'd ask certain guys to wear wires in games, and they'd say, like, maybe next week or if we win this week, you know. So we would, like, I would work with people to just kind of make sure everybody was comfortable with exactly who was putting a microphone on. One thing I have been really pleasantly surprised with is we, you know, we made sure that we sent the show out to some of the guys on the team who, like, really worked with us a lot last year. And the feedback has been kind of awesome. Like, just, I think it got to a point where everybody was actually glad that we were there, because they were like, we work hard. Like, and the NFL is not easy. And the first, I mean, up until, I want to say, like, week 10 or 11, I mean, they were in every single game except week one. But, like, for a while there, they were in every game. And I think they see the value in the fact that we're going to be able to show that, like, they worked hard and they prepared every week and things don't always go your way. So for the most part, like, guys like Aaron Donald, I think, like, they value that, you know, we can show their hard work.
Interesting. Shannon Furman joining us from NFL Films. So two very identifiable and interesting characters which you had to portray and document, and that was Jeff Fisher and Jared Goff. I want your take on Jeff Fisher, having been around him behind the scenes. What type of guy do you think you saw? What type of coach did you observe? What type of person did you think that you were rolling on in terms of a head coach there?
I think Jeff Fisher, the one thing that I can tell you I noticed about him is he treats the janitor the same way he treats Jared Goff, the star quarterback, his first pick. You know, he's very fair. I think the one thing he would say, too, is that he did too much last year with the move, with everything. Instead of just coaching the football team, he was involved in, like, the travel and the moving around and, like, just everything, like, logistical things that a normal head coach doesn't have to worry about. I mean, like, on a weekly basis, he couldn't just concentrate on football. And he told me that in an interview, that was one of the things he regrets, is that he feels like maybe he was, you know, he should have just, like, if he could have just stuck to the football, that would have helped him out a lot last year. But I see a coach that his players love him. I mean, even when, you know, star players from the other team would come up to him pregame and say that they want to play for him. And I had never met Coach Fisher until Hard Knocks. I maybe interviewed him once or twice in my career, but didn't really know him. And I mean, I think, like, I have probably a lifelong friend in this guy now because of the trust he put in letting NFL Films stick around. I mean, he's been doing this a long time. So I think he really enjoyed Hard Knocks, and it was great for us because he used to come watch the show with us on Tuesday nights with the crew, and he would bring some of the other guys from the coaching staff. But I mean, his players love him. I think they do a lot. They would do a lot for him. Their reaction when he was fired was, I mean, it was emotional. I think, like, just the looks on their faces and some of the stuff the guys say that you'll see in episode 6, like, tell you everything you need to know about Jeff Fisher, the man, the coach, all of that.
But then what did you see from Jared Goff finally? Because this was a young man that was expected to be the franchise quarterback, and he did not get that chance for a long time of the season. He was dealing with a lot of criticism and people wondering if he was ready or not. What did you see from Jared Goff behind the scenes?
I see a tough kid in Jared. Jared put up with a lot with us, with our cameras. We essentially followed Jared for almost the first year of his career in the NFL because he also did, on top of Hard Knocks and All or Nothing, he did Hey Rookie with us, which I run that show too here. So we do that. So he, coming out of January and finishing up at Cal, he started filming that show with us. So Jared has been under a microscope for a while now, and he handled it all was a complete professional. I think he's one of the guys too that I was saying before values, you know, that fact that we're going to be able to show the hard work that they all put into it. I think Jared loves football. I'm hoping Sean McVay is going to be good for him this year. But, like, Jared was actually great to work with. And him and Case had a really great relationship. We were all surprised at Hard Knocks that we kept waiting for the day that Jared was going to be named the starter, and then that never happened. And I think that was probably a good decision, like, just to kind of, cause Case is a really good leader. So, but just watching that quarterback room work, like, Jared and Case had a great relationship. And I think Case was probably very helpful to Jared. I'm confident that Jared is going to do well. He has a good mentality to be there. It's kind of like he has a mentality where he doesn't really care what people have to say about him. I think to be a quarterback in the league, you kind of have to be able to brush things off like that.
All or Nothing, a season with the L.A. Rams, produced by NFL Films, available exclusively on Amazon Prime Video starting this Friday. And you can binge watch and watch all the episodes at once. All or Nothing follows the Rams throughout the entire season. Last year, their first year in L.A. Shannon Furman is an NFL Films producer with the show. Shannon, this was a lot of fun. Looking forward to the series. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's interesting that we have the behind-the-scenes look at Jeff Fisher now with this season-long series in the wake of Vince Young saying, I'm going to expose his ass. Saying that he was vindictive and really got in the way of Vince Young's development. Interesting. The VY conversation in Sports Illustrated with Greg Bishop, the piece that Bishop wrote in SI coming up here. I think it's this week or next week. Really, really good stuff. It's available online at SI.com. It's worth the read. We talked about that in the first hour of the show. When we come back, we've got your cut line, including the BYU-Utah Holy War taking a spin on things with beverages and your epic fail, DA, CBS Sports Radio.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Are the glitch in the simulation.
You know, Aaron Rodgers broke his heart. Hashtag stay away from me, buddy. A video that, you know, I've gone to psychological counseling for.
DA on CBS Sports Radio.
Understandably so. 40 minutes past the hour. DA with you.
Puffiness with sodium.
CBS Sports Radio, 855-212-4CBS. 855-212-4227. As always, you can hit us on Twitter as well, DA on CBS. You know, there was this story by Vince Young about cooking turkey necks, talking about how Ryan Fitzpatrick still has a job, but he's over here cooking turkey necks. And I'm like, boy, I've never had turkey necks. So I had to look up a good turkey neck recipe. Kermit Ruffin is a famous New Orleans jazz musician and trumpeter. And NOLA.com, the New Orleans website, New Orleans newspaper website, has Kermit Ruffin's hot and spicy turkey necks recipe. Take 10 pounds of turkey necks, 1 cup of Zatarain's crab and seafood boil. Fantastic stuff. I've had that. 1/3 cup cayenne pepper, 2 bay leaves, salt, 2 lemons, 2 onions, some garlic, and a half bunch of celery. Now, apparently this is a good soul food dish. I've never had good turkey necks. Rinse the turkey necks, put in a pot, add water to cover completely. Medium heat, add the crab boil, cayenne pepper, salt, lemons, bay leaves. Cut the onions in half, drop them into the pot, remove as much outer peel as possible from garlic, and add the whole heads to the pot. Stir, cover, let cook for about 2 hours. If you want the turkey necks real tender, juicy, and spicy, allow them to soak in the pot for 20 minutes after turning the heat off, and then you'll be swinging with Kermit Ruffin's hot and spicy turkey necks. Now, I like turkey, I like soul food, and I love the idea of some type of turkey in some type of seafood boil. And I trust almost anything that I would eat in New Orleans. It's my favorite eating city in America. However, the necks of the turkey, I don't know if that seems all that appetizing, Mraz. Could I get you to eat
puffiness with sodium?
Some necks of turkeys?
I've debated a turkey neck the last few Thanksgivings when discussing pieces of the turkey.
Is that right?
And I've come to this conclusion. No. Not a freaking chance. When you got beautiful breasts, beautiful thighs, beautiful drumsticks, why would you want to eat the neck of a turkey?
Huh. Now, have you ever had fish face, fish cheeks?
No, I've never eaten fish face in my life.
Fish cheeks. Now, the meat around under the fish eyes and right in front of the gills is a very tender piece of meat. People eat fish cheeks.
But it's got to be very small. Like, that's not going to
Very small.
You're not throwing fish cheeks on the grill and getting filled up.
It will not fill you up like a burger or a steak.
You need to eat like this. You need to eat like
this. It's not a pot roast size fish cheek.
Need a 7,000-pound tuna to get enough cheek meat.
Yeah, there's no, like, whale cheek you could eat. But so, I don't know. I guess I would try it. The only part of the bird I'm not real thrilled about is the feet. I still don't ever think I could get over eating the feet of the bird. But
yeah.
The neck, there might be some good meat in the neck.
Maybe.
There's some good meat in your neck.
But I need a boneless neck then. There is good meat in my neck. You need to chisel it off the bone. You know what I mean? I don't want to be picking meat off the neck bone.
You don't want to be eating it right off the neck bone.
No way. I'm a fat lord. Oh, okay. I'm queasy for lunch.
All right. Okay. Hey, so do we have breaking news over here or what?
Yeah,
is this legit?
This is legit. I've checked it. This is a real Woj. Real Woj bomb.
Real Woj bomb. Adrian Wojnarowski from The Vertical and Yahoo Sports, soon to be ESPN. The real bomb is that Chris Paul has been traded to the Houston Rockets. Is that right?
Yeah, he has opted into his deal with LA, and they are sending him to the Houston Rockets, I believe in a deal for Patrick Beverley, among others.
Guess it's time now for a little cut line.
These stories were left out by the selection committee. Cut from their high school team. The news that didn't make the show. It's the cut line.
Well, I need to see what the Rockets gave up to get Chris Paul. Because Patrick Beverley is an excellent defensive player. But you can definitely give him up if you're getting Chris Paul in return. I wonder how much they gave up. Is there Lou Williams in there as well? I wonder what type of salaries they had to move. It's Decker, Williams,
Beverly, and a 2018 first-round pick for Paul.
My inclination is this makes the Rockets better. I'm not sure by how much. Chris Paul is an excellent point guard. Chris Paul is a future Hall of Fame point guard. Chris Paul gives you another ball handler and option, obviously. But how much of that is now kind of redundant in Houston because the primary ball handler was James Harden? I mean, James Harden is the guy that became an MVP candidate by handling the basketball on every possession. And now you're going to take it out of James Harden's hands and give it to Chris Paul and now make James Harden the off-ball guard again? Boy, after all the success the Rockets had, they're willing to just kind of throw that in there? I'm intrigued, obviously, because it's an assemblage of stars. I'm intrigued, obviously, because that means it's the end of the Clippers as we know it. I'm not sure how much better this makes the Rockets because they just seem to kind of hit on something in this past season. I suppose it means you could run even more. Now it's Harden and Chris Paul pushing tempo. But boy, that's an interesting move. I mean, look, in the offseason, the NBA just never fails to disappoint. Just days before the free agency begins, Chris Paul is traded right now to the Houston Rockets. Breaking news. Chris Paul to the Houston Rockets for Beverly, Williams, Decker, and a first-round pick next year. If I'm the Clippers and I want to start over, this is a good way to start over because I get a first-rounder back. I don't know if any of the other parts really end up becoming all that important. Now you have to decide on Blake Griffin. It makes you wonder if they're going to say goodbye to Blake Griffin as well. But here's one thing that we knew. That Chris Paul and Blake Griffin did not get along really well. And that maybe they were trying to decide between one or the other. And maybe they felt like Chris Paul had eyes elsewhere anyway. That, by the way, is a big loss for the San Antonio Spurs. Because if the Spurs were trying to clear space to bring in Chris Paul, see, that's where I think it would make more sense. If Chris Paul is your point guard in San Antonio with Kawhi playing off the ball and then LaMarcus Aldridge underneath, that seems to make more sense than trying to pair Chris Paul with a guy like James Harden that needs the ball in his hands so much. Daryl Morey is not scared to take chances. This is another chance. I'm just wondering if James Harden likes this move. I mean, I guess that he does because it adds another star to the puzzle, and I'm sure that he feels like he could use somebody to take some scoring load off of him, and Chris Paul could be that guy. But boy, I don't know. I mean, I appreciate aggressive moves, but are the Rockets better having added Chris Paul alongside James Harden? I'm not so sure about that.
So sorry, you've been cut.
Thank you. Goodbye.
That's your cut line. It's time for your Ask the Pros question of the day, brought to you by O'Reilly Auto Parts. Sign up to be an O-Rewards member today. Start earning instantly. O-Rewards members get $5 back for every 150 points that you earn. Fast, easy, free, only at O'Reilly Auto Parts. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better prices every day. A lot of tweets coming in over the course of today after the Phil Jackson news. Rob tweeting, Phil gets paid while his whole deal goes off and gets to retire now. Guess what? He wins. Anthony tweets in, do you see Phil Jackson ever resurfacing again as a consultant for another NBA team like Jerry West in the future? Never taking on a full-time job, only maybe being a consultant. Never a coach, never an executive, never a GM. Yes, a consultant job maybe he would take because it's an easy paycheck, but would any team ever give him that job? I mean, think about it. His personnel decisions led the Knicks to this nightmare scenario. Would you then pay for his opinions on assembling a basketball team? You might pay him for his opinions on coaching a team. You might pay him for his opinions on motivating players, but you would never pay him any good money to let him tell you how to build a roster. So I'm not really convinced he'll ever have an opportunity to be a consultant in that way. Unless it's Jeannie Buss in Los Angeles, because those two are smooching. And yes, I use the word smooching. Let's get your epic fail of the morning, boys and girls. And today's epic fail is courtesy of Charlie Sheen owning one of the coolest pieces of baseball memorabilia ever.
Even the DH show is not perfect. We know. Shocking. Here's the epic fail.
Charlie Sheen also had the contract that sent Babe Ruth from the Red Sox to the Yankees in 1919. Charlie Sheen owns that contract, which is like the most famous document in baseball history.
Find a more less trustworthy person than Charlie Sheen to have that contract.
Totally. We trusted Morales.
I don't even think I said that right. More least trustworthy?
Definitely did not.
Either way, the answer is still you.
Yeah. It would be number one, least trustworthy, Morales. Number two, Charlie Sheen. And only Charlie Sheen inching towards Morales on a heavy Coke binge that goes like 2 weeks. So, can you imagine on a random Saturday night, Hollywood Hills, whatever, you're on a bender with Charlie Sheen. He's like, yeah, come back to my place. Come back, I got some cool stuff to show you.
Better teach this kid some control before he kills somebody.
And you're thinking like, he's got the old Sean Kemp Rain Man poster, or maybe he's got like an autograph from Corbin Burnson from Major League. Maybe he's got like, you know, something like that. And he's like, yeah, come over. Come on, we'll do shots. Yeah, we'll do some lines. Yeah, we'll do some drugs. Yeah, let's do.
All right, Vaughn, they tell us you're a pitcher. You're sure not much of a dresser.
And he comes over and you're like, all right, what are we going to see here? Like, are we going to watch Major League 2? No. Here is Babe Ruth's contract of being sold to the Yankees.
I don't know, maybe not from this particular terrestrial realm.
And you know he just probably had it stashed under the bar right next to the Seagrams. Like, I got it somewhere. That guy in his bar downstairs. Not in Cooperstown.
That has nothing to do with me, really. I mean, they're entitled to, I suppose.
Charlie Sheen's bar downstairs.
Next to an empty Domino's box.
God. Oh, just heartbreaking.
Epic fail, you loser.
Yes.
is why you fail.
Epic fail.
By the way, on the Chris Paul trade, Adrian Wojnarowski tweeting that James Harden and Chris Paul were determined to play together. So on the surface, it feels like a bad basketball move. Two guys that need the rock in their hands, two point guards basically, as James Harden developed into that last season. But I guess they both understand the pitfalls potentially of both of them playing together. The Rock has become interesting even more so with Chris Paul and James Harden teamed up. I don't know if it makes them better, though. I'm sure we'll talk a lot about that on tomorrow's show as well. And I mentioned this story going out to break, which was going to be part of the cut line before Chris Paul hijacked it. The holy war between Utah and BYU, one of the best rivalries in all of sports. Utah obviously doesn't want a lot of BYU blue on campus, but they just signed a deal, a marketing deal with Pepsi and Pepsi products. So they're not going to allow Pepsi's blue to be in any of their signage on campus. And Pepsi obviously is red and blue. So they've asked Pepsi to remove the blue from their logo, or at least from the signage, not from the logo, but from the signage that they will have around campus. And there will be a heavier lean towards Code Red Mountain Dew in their stadium. Oh, good. Perfect. Exactly what I want to drink during a football game. Thanks to Sean Mraz, executive producer. Pete the Body Bellotti on the Wheels of Steel. Chris Arnt Thomas as your digital broadcast producer. And Andrew Bogish on your headlines. I'm DA and the Mothership Disconnects.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.